Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Strange Magic After Midnight, where our inspiration takes us to some very unexpected places. I'm your host, Incoherent Dust, here tonight with my co-host, Victoria Frost. And this show is brought to you by the Late Night Poets of AllPoetry.com. You don't have to be a member of the group or the website to enjoy the show or call in and read a piece of your own. But if you like poetry, we highly recommend it. We host shows every night of the week on a variety of different topics and themes, and there's something for everyone to enjoy. This evening, we're bringing you poetry inspired by a quote from Gillian Flynn's novel, Sharp Objects. A child weaned on poison considers harm a comfort. And there's a lot of deep takes in the poems on this show, so I can't wait to get into them with you all. And so let's go ahead and get started. Victoria, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Mika?
I'm doing great. I'm excited for tonight's show. It got delayed, so... it would be nice to get
it
through.
It did. Well, and that's exactly it. I was so excited last week because there is some really amazing writes that came out of this contest because I think it's really like deeply thought provoking and it really makes you kind of it really makes you kind of sit and think on the ways in which life and people can impact us. At least that's how I kind of took it. And so I'm really excited about what came from this, because I think it's just, I think we've got some really stellar rights. And I was so sad last week or the other week that it just was not playing along, but that's technology for you.
Yep. That's how she goes sometimes. And we have, I believe Felon is on with us. Felon, is that you?
Am I off mute?
Oh, hey.
Hi,
Felon.
What's up?
Hola. You're sounding better than the last time I got to hear you. That's good. How are you feeling?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm able to walk some now. I've been having to learn how to rewalk, and they want me to use my muscles in my mouth, believe that or not. They messed up saying that. So I'm trying my best to stretch out these vocal cords, and so just bear with me.
Well, we're glad to have you on, Felon. Appreciate you.
Absolutely, man. This COVID is not a it's no joke. I got the variant D, and it settled. I had pneumonia, COVID with a hypotensive something else. I mean, it in just one day like that, I was on a vent in less than 1 day from the first symptom. So, please, people, get vaccinated. Please, please, please. For real.
Yeah, absolutely. That's just going a little better at least.
I'm ready to talk about some poison. I'm glad it didn't happen because I wanted to read my poem.
I'm glad you're here to read it. Always good to hear it in your voice. And I'm glad you're feeling well enough. Let me give Allison in the chat the link really quick.
Okay, I'm here to I'm gonna stay the whole time, hopefully.
All right, well, I'll go ahead and put your poem up first. Let me get that lined up. And here we go, Felon. Go ahead and give that a read when you get a chance.
I absolutely loved the prompt. I mean, it was just like it spoke to me. And let's see. I'm sorry about that. Here we go. It's called Nurture. Nursing on Satan's breast, suckling sin as if it were on tap. Living a feast made just to make my life sting. Coddled amongst the fires of hell, rocked to melodies of manipulating sinister laughs. Scorched way before I was able to even read. Misery tucked me into bed as it held on to my dreams. Demonic flare kept flames to my feet, making shoes impossible to wear. Removing the offer to allowing others to walk in mine, comfort within torture would have paired best if it had weaned my fears in poison. End poem.
Oh, Felon, this is a fantastic write, and I'm sitting here in goosebumps. I'm so glad you were able to call in and read this piece, because I don't think anybody else could have done it justice. Thank you for that. And, Lisa, would you mind sharing your thoughts?
Oh, yeah. I love this. You start off with a kick, nursing on Satan's breast, suckling sin as if it were on tap. What an opening line. I just think you bring such raw intensity with your writes, and this one even hits a little deeper for me. Milking a feast made just to make my life sting. There's such pain in that. As someone, you know, who was raised, I guess the way that I was raised makes this resonate very, very deeply with me. Misery tucked me into bed. Demonic flare kept flames to my feet. Like, there's just this this torment that is so clear throughout the piece. And your language is completely unambiguous, but so, so beautiful. I really loved it.
Thank you. I mean, when I wrote it, really, I'll be honest with you, Mika. I mean, I was just thinking, what would Mika say in this shit? What would she say? I'm going to get raw like Mika. I'm just going to get down and ugly.
Well, I'm so glad you did.
I left the rhyme off, and I just said, you know what? I'm fixing to just bust it out. And really, it was, I mean, I really, sometimes I was like, what would Mika say in this? And that's what I went with.
Honestly, I think that's awesome. And I think you did such a great job even capturing, like, Mika's spirit in this, because there is that rawness to it. I mean, it bites in its words. Just like what Mika even said, nursing on Satan's breast, suckling sin as if it were on tap. There are so many times in life where people make us feel like the bad guy, like the villain, be it because of what we believe, how we think, political beliefs. I mean, there's so many different ways. In fact, my brother-in-law, I was actually talking with Pam about this today, because I got to talk to my sister for the first time in 7 years. We spent 5 hours talking, and it's the first time we've really gotten to talk besides like two ships passing in the night whenever she would visit my parents and I'd happen to be there. We got to talk for 5 hours, first time in 7 years. And it's because when I met my now husband, my brother-in-law knew that I was 2 months away from finalizing a divorce from my ex-husband, who I'd been separated from for over a year. But because a little piece of paper still said that I was technically married, even though he already had like on his second or third girlfriend by that time, because there was a little piece of paper, I'm an evil adulteress. And so this really reminds me of that, the way in which people villainize us. And so often how, especially when it comes to like family, and my therapist has even said this, especially when things come to family, we so desperately want a relationship with our family that often we are allowing them to villainize us. We allow them to make us the scapegoat because there's just that deep need to be loved and accepted by the people that you come from. But this, I feel, really hits the nail on the head. It really does go after the idea that it goes after the idea and the feeling that we can be reminded of so many times as if we were this child suckling on the breast of Satan. We're not actually evil. Sometimes we are misunderstood, and we slowly come to understand that it is not us who are the problem. Sometimes it is others. And that's part of that shedding of the toxic relationships in our life. I think you just really beautifully captured this in hard-hitting words that make people stop and think and find those times where they felt like they were that child, that creature, only to realize that ultimately they're not the problem. Just a really stunning job, Sally.
You know, if we were, it's the sins of others that we actually nurse on as youth, that's what develops our minds into what and how we perceive things and how we accept things in life or how we view them. And then, you know, we're coddled amongst the fires of hell, basically, because we're already being, you know, lit up on a daily basis, or our innocence has been taken from us, and all we know is to do what's the wrong thing instead of the right. And then at the end of the day, you know, you're not even read, but, you know, the misery is the comfort, because that's all you know. It is, you know, you can put the flames to my feet or whatever, it don't matter, I'm not wearing any shoes anyway, and you're not going to wear them. And, you know, comfort is the torture, because we've been weaned off the fears and poison, and that's because, you know, we fear ourselves and fear our thoughts and fear our past. We just need to forgive and move forward and just, you know, be ourselves and don't worry about suckling on anything but our own sins, and just keep on going. That's how I see it. So I'm glad.
I love it. Sorry, Mika. It sounded like maybe I cut you off there.
No, you didn't. No.
I love the commentary. Love it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Solon. I think. Well, I think this is stunning. So thank you, Felon. Truly. I think you're hitting a hard truth here. So thank you for that. And Mika, where do you want to take us next?
Okay. Well, next up we have a write by Lou Woodfay called Poison's Charm. And I'll give us a read. The witch's daughter was weaned on poison since she was born from pain and despair. carefully conditioned to weed out the good. The witch used hemlock for her daughter's hair, so she could easily see the evil in others' ways. Aconite drops were put into the girl's eyes. Venus was her name, and deception was her game. Kindness as a deception became her disguise. For cheeks that blush and turn men's heads, Belladonna, which means beautiful lady, makes up the list of her poisonous gifts. You get sucked in before you know that she's crazy. Raised only on the deadliest and most damaging. Nothing evil could do her any harm. You won't survive, but Venus will thrive because of all the poison as part of her charm. End poem.
Oh, my goodness. What a stunning poem. I think what really strikes me is the way in which this feels almost like a recipe. It feels like a mythology of old where perhaps there is a god or a goddess that is building and creating this creature for a purpose. It shows intent and wisdom in the life that they are preparing this child for. And the fact that there's a rhyme scheme in it, it feels like one of those old lores, something that's catchy so that you'll remember it and perhaps even find your own strength in it. Just a really, really stunning rite. I'm so glad that they entered into this because it doesn't just show poison. It doesn't just show how poison can be a part of us, not necessarily because it's evil, but perhaps even as a way to defend ourselves. But it also shows how to every quote-unquote negative, there's also something beautiful and good that can be seen in it. And we even see that with "For cheeks that blush and turn men's head, Belladonna," which means beautiful lady, makes up the list of her poisonous gifts, yet gets sucked in before you know that she's crazy. Again, that beautiful balance of the good and the bad. And it's only those who treat her well or poorly that will find those sides. I think this is just a really stunning rite. And Fallon, what did you think of this?
This was absolutely whoa for me. I like the cadence in it as well, like the scheme. It you don't really notice it right off, but it just flows so effortless off your tongue, and I like that. I like when you can actually have a scheme that's effortless and it's not forced. It seems like it's put together very well, and I don't think there was any word that was wasted really in this piece. And like, she could easily see the evil in others' way. Antidote drops were put into the girl's eyes. I like that. Venus was her name, and deception was the game. Kindness as deception became her disguise. That is, I love it, because drops were basically it's a plant, and it's poisonous, very, very poisonous. And I like that, because basically saying she just from even from the seed being seeded, she is birthed or bloomed to be deadly. And I like that. And I love the last line. You get stuck, I like that one too. You get sucked in before you know she's crazy. I think that should work for me. But because of all the poison is a part of her charm. And I like that, because that's what her attributes or her characteristics that makes up her. Is because she's born into a witch's brew, basically, or to that of practicing, or sorcery and such. But that she'll make you lust her just being the poison that she is. That's part of her charm. This is just, I think this is beautifully written and very, very intellect and very great storytelling as well. Great job.
Yes, Ms. Fallon. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And Mika, what did you think of it?
So I might be off the wall here, but I like it, and I took it as more of a broader social commentary on the way that that women generationally respond to the patriarchy in our society. The fact that the first line is the witch's daughter, and that the witch is brought in at all, first of all, is making me immediately go to what happened with the witch scares in history, and what it really was about was controlling and punishing women who were outside of
the societal expectation for them. And in the poem, I think we get kind of the sense of how the societal expectation on women can kind of be turned against men, can be used as a weapon. And it is poisonous to be retributive. But at the same time, it seems like this generational knowledge that's being passed down is this is the only weapon you have. This is your strength. Kindness as a deception. Cheeks that blush and turn men's heads. Use your beauty. Use the veneer of kindness of womanly nurturing to thrive. And I don't know. I really like that. I think it's both a criticism of and also just a description of the way that women have been forced to get by in society. And I think to an extent I was raised to be performative in this way as well. And the performance is actually a life skill, the performance of femininity. So I thought it was really deep. I really liked it.
I think that's a really stunning comment, actually. And I want to comment on it because as I was listening to you speak, it kind of reminds me of how, especially now as there is confrontation of the patriarchy, so often women are villainized in being seductresses, which would have been something that a witch would have been accused of. You know, we're accused of being catfished because we put on makeup. Logically, if a man like could look beyond what he's seeing immediately, then they would also recognize that, yeah, makeup's going to enhance things. Like there's going to be that you're not seeing them as they're going to wake up in the morning. But the need to villainize when something is shown to be equal to, superior, or and or considered a threat, I think that you're right. I think this piece really does speak in that way. I think that it does, in its own way, remind us that women are powerful and that we don't always need to be the meek housewife, and in a way prepare us for the backlash that can come of it. Because let's be honest, there are a lot of people that would still like us to be in the 1950s and the men worked and the women were housewives and they kept their mouths shut and they were seen and not heard. And that's just not the society that we are in now, or at least the society that we're trying to become. So I think that's actually a really phenomenal and insightful comment. So thank you for that, Mika. I really appreciated that take on it. And where do you want to
say woman?
Oh, sorry. Sorry, Fallon. Say what you were going to say.
Say woman. Yeah, that's what that song, that's what reminds me of that song.
Yes.
And where do you want to take it? I know we spent a lot of time on this poem, but I really was interested in it. So I just want to comment again to your point as well. It's not just that that women have a power, in their performative femininity. There's also something to be said about how the way that the poem talks about the poison. It's not just that it's a poison for men either. The child is raised on the poison. So it's not
right.
It's like the poison is cutting both ways, and I think that's very true to women's experience in life. It's yes, you are constrained by this expectation of your performance of femininity, but also you receive some benefits from buying into it, not from just buying into it, but from exerting that. So
yeah.
I don't know. I really like what you had to say, and I was thinking the poison is a double-edged sword in this poem. It's a poison to the men that she uses the power to influence or to manipulate, and it's also a poison to her herself because it is a prison in its own right.
Oh, I love that. I really, really love that take on it, Mika. Like, truly, and it's such it brings such a strength to it. It's not just this mythical lore thing, but it's something that can be empowering to women who are going through those things. And actually your comment, not to keep talking about my ex-husband, but your comment actually reminded me of when I was going through my divorce with my ex-husband, because since I was the one who stepped away, it was his fourth affair, and so I was done. My mother called me a Jezebel, not because I was actually doing anything, but she called me a Jezebel, and she told my ex-husband that I would go out and sow my oats, and then I would come back to him, and he just had to have faith, even though he was the one sowing his oats. But it does go back to that notion of what a woman should be, even if it is to their detriment. And, I love your comment, because even in that context, it can be a reminder of too, of yes, this is a double-edged sword. Yes, this can harm you. But at the same time, it can be something for you to find strength in these difficult times, because you understand the impact of all of this. So really, thank you for that comment, Nika. And thank you guys for engaging in this conversation.
I know. This is such an interesting conversation. I don't want to let it go, because it's like, it's also like, it brings back the argument of is female sexuality, and reveling in female sexuality empowerment. Like, we see all this argument over the song WAP. I mean, you guys, are you familiar with the controversy surrounding that? And there's this whole argument of whether or not there's this argument of whether or not females owning their sexuality is empowerment, or is it also a byproduct of the patriarchy? It's very interesting. I don't know. This poem has a lot.
I think
I
have one more comment now because of that.
Okay. Go ahead.
So my grandmother passed away in 2011, and my grandmother she was in her 70s, but still, like, when you think of that, 70s in 2011, that means like 1940s, 1930s is the eras in which she was raised in. And I distinctly remember going through her house after she had passed away. My grandpa just did not have the means to do so. There was a book that she was given before her wedding. And in it, it said that a woman's job during the act of intimacy was to lay there, that she was not intended to get pleasure from it. She should not expect pleasure for it. She was there for the man's bidding. And so I think that that's a really interesting thing to kind of ruminate on, the idea of women claiming their sexuality and their sensuality. Is it something of the patriarchy so that men can have a woman who's more eager and willing in bed? Because let's be honest, nobody wants a dead fish. But at the same time, we have this villainization because we do not have chaste little virgins anymore. We have people who understand their worth and their beauty, and who are willing to demand fair and equal treatment, whereas historically they were given books that they didn't deserve any of that, which I think is really interesting if you start looking back at the cultural progression of this female revolution, if you will, because Oh, go ahead, Fallon.
I didn't know there was another position besides laying on your back like a fish.
Oh, my God. Fallon, I don't believe that. But you know, it is a really interesting thing because, you know, there always is the question of manipulation because, let's be honest, it's prevalent throughout society. But I love that thought because in so many ways we still see how poison has leached into our society, especially when it comes to female empowerment. So anyways, I love it. I love that thought. I want to have like a whole show now on it. Like, I think we could have a whole show inspired by this poem. Yes.
Great poem, Lou Woodfay. Really good contribution. Excellent conversation, everybody. But we do have to move on because we have a lot of poems, and I'm sure we'll have some interesting discussions on the remaining ones. So without further ado, Victoria, will you read the next poem by Becky Upchurch?
Oh, I would love to. All right. This is Bone Grip by Becky Upchurch. When I met her in the office, first thought, meek, mild, told me more about me. For when she began speaking, she fingered her arms, picking away syllables of pain, cautiously choosing which words to bleed out. A sly, feral cat so hungry to survive, she chose to come feed with me. And not long into our sessions, this full-grown child of abuse painted a picture of her mother and of her. No surprise who was stroked in vibrant color and who was dismally hiding in a pallid blue bone grip of death. The poison was working until she vomited it out in my office, and her breath of words grew stronger paragraphs, giving her shape in colors of hope, in syllables of worth, and her arms, scabbed, scarred flesh, tilted her book, The End of Generations, titled her book, The End of Generations, cutting hemlock from her story. Finally, an end page in sight. End poem. Oh my gosh, this is another stunning piece. Fallon, would you mind starting us off with what you thought of it?
Well, if I can stop crying. Oh my God. This is very empowering, and I think it really speaks volumes, and it's just very, very powerful. How, you know, we see people sometimes, we actually see the meek and the mild, and we see the childlike behavior and them being so cautiously of how they share themselves with the world and those around them, because they fear being, you know, rejected, or fear being seen as something that they're not, and that that person's always picking, and but yet really it's others who are picking. They're picking at the scars because they don't know what the cut is and how deep it is, and what it's caused. You know, that they're basically in what they call a decompensated shock. They're almost at a point where there's no return. But I like where she says, you know, no surprise who spoke in the vibrant color and who was in the dismayed hiding in the pale blue grip, bone grip of death. The poison was working. Yeah, it was working all right. That was the poison of her mother. Her mother always had something negative to say, always putting her down, you know, making her hold her head down. So finally she was able to vomit the things that happened to her, and she gained a voice, her own voice, and no longer did she have to pick. She was actually stroking those wounds and giving them the flesh, the tone back to its own pores. And, you know, she cut the hem, you know, like she said, cutting the hemlock from her story, because you can rewrite your story at any point in time. And there is an end page in sight in chapters in life, but I don't think there's an end page in sight until our last day that we take our last breath. But this is just absolutely powerful and bone gripping. Just wow.
Beautifully said, Fallon. Thank you. And Mika, what did you think?
I really love this piece. I agree with Fallon about the mother's poison. To me, this speaks of the kind of parent-child relationship that's abusive in such a way that it's not apparent to the person who is abused. It's almost like maybe it's like a mental illness, like narcissism or something, where everything has always been about the mother. And maybe the person that has been so harmed by this upbringing thinks that they deserve to give all their attention to the parent, that the parent deserves sympathy, that they deserve all the attention that they act out in order to get. Because when we talk about the part that Fallon called out, no surprise who was who stroked in vibrant color and who was dismally hiding in a pallid blue bone grip of death. It seems like this parasitic relationship where the abused sees the abuser in these vibrant tones and has everything to say about justifying their behavior, and they had no room to appreciate or to develop themselves. And to fully flesh out their own personhood, because it was always that they were defined only in relation to their abuser, and not as a person unto themselves.
And so it's beautiful. I feel like she probably is a therapist, that this is written from personal experience. That's just the sense that I get, because it's so true to life. But I love this almost at the end, cutting hemlock from her story, cutting the poison out. And that to me is like breaking the cycle of abuse that keeps you returning and giving, feeding that parasite that sinks their fangs into you and continues to mess with your life, even into adulthood when you're less vulnerable, because the groundwork is laid for you to constantly orient yourself around them. I have experience with a narcissistic parent, so it could just be me projecting my own experience onto this, but it reminds me of an analogy that I once read about the boat rocker. And it was about how when you have a parent who's narcissistic, it's like you and your family are in a boat, and that person is constantly running from one side to the other, throwing off the balance. And everyone else in the family knows that it's their duty to run from one side to the other opposite them to keep the boat from tipping over, to keep the craziness from overwhelming, to keep that person from going underwater. And they feel that duty constantly to run back and forth. Now, if someone comes along and or one of the family members decides that it's not their duty to do that anymore and they want to step off the boat, everyone else will recriminate them and talk shit, because they need you to balance out the boat so that it won't turn over.
Oh my God.
But nobody is willing to turn around and put the blame on who it actually belongs on, the person who actually consistently tries to rock the boat and overturn it. And I think that's what I'm kind of getting from this. It's like the person can't see until they are given the benefit of objective outside opinion of the therapist. That the blame lies not within themselves, but on the person who has basically been parasitically feeding on them. I thought it was just a really true life, down to earth, right, and very well written.
Oh my goodness, Mika, what a stunning comment. And I love that you even brought in the idea of a narcissist, because I'll be honest, that was my thought too as I was reading this. But your comment actually reminded me of something, because like you, I dealt with a narcissistic parent and an enabler, which is usually the dynamic that you see. But my mother is narcissistic, and my father is the enabler. It made me think even about the words that have been spoken, the way in which these parents will speak to their children. And I'd actually talked to Phil about this, because I'd had a very interesting conversation with my mother in which she made the comment that I am her favorite child. I'm not. I know I'm not. I'm not the golden child. But her descriptor of me was, you are my centerpiece, which is a really interesting, like if you dig into the psychology of it, it's a really interesting idea to say that your favorite child is a centerpiece, because what do you do with a centerpiece? You put it on a table, you put it on a shelf, and you ignore it to collect dust. In her mind, it was justified because, you know, she's displaying me, and you don't display what you don't care about. But truth be told, she wanted to put me in a place and make me stay there. And then when I didn't, I was a disappointment. And so I love your comment, because I agree. I do think that this does describe not just abuse. I do believe that there's even that narcissism, because a narcissist will pick and will blame. They will leave scratches and welts and wounds upon your soul and your psyche. And then they'll always have the reason for why it's your fault. And it's a cycle you can't win, because like you said, if you rebel against it, everyone goes against you. You become the black sheep because you are not doing what everybody else thinks you should do, just to keep things going as they are used to, not because that's how they should work. A boat should never be rocking to the extent where we're afraid of it tipping over. And yet in these situations, people are so conditioned, they are so poisoned in their soul that they choose to ignore it or they choose to assume that it's normal. So I think that was such a stunning comment and so perfectly appropriate for this piece, because I agree, it really does dig into the psychology of how these relationships can poison us. And even personally, I have and do struggle with my own self-worth, because if I'm not useful, then I'm worth nothing in my family, which is probably why I have the only career path that people can actually use in my family. But it does really speak to the way in which these things, even small, these words, these relationships can impact us for so long, and how it is only when we are forced to vomit the poison out of our soul, forced to reconcile the fact that it was freely fed to us, claimed to be nectar, that we just had to get used to. It's only in those moments when we start to understand that truly it was a way to keep us down and to hurt us and to keep us weak and under their control, that we can finally start to understand truly how much these relationships, truly how toxic these relationships are to us. And it is only then that we can end the story of that book, be it not continuing the cycle with our own family, with our own children, or be it finally coming to a close and cutting ties, going no contact, going partial contact with family that will never allow you to be less than the black sheep who refuses to keep the boat afloat. Just a stunning write and fantastic comment, guys. Thank you. And where do you want to take us now, Micah?
Preach, Victoria, preach. It is so good. I know that me and you both have narcissistic parent upbringings, but my narcissistic father literally told me that I was his favorite when I was trying to confront him about some of the things that had been done in the past as a manipulation tactic. So when you said that, I was just shocked. Like, they're so predictable. It's like it's unbelievable that the experience can be that universal, that you have the exact same experience that I do. That's just crazy. Because I knew it was bullshit. You knew it was bullshit, but it's just crazy. Like that. I don't know. You know what? It just shocked me that that happened to you in exactly the same way. That's
Well, insane. And I think, you know, it's again that it's that poison, it's that nectar, it's the manipulation, like you said, to get people to do what they want. Because if they can gaslight you and say, well, don't you understand, you're my favorite, then you're just going to rethink everything and be like, oh, well, maybe I misread all of that. Because again, it puts the blame on us for not understanding that, oh, we were truly their favorite. It's just one of those, it's insult to injury. And as you get away from it, you start to realize just how pathetic those behaviors are, that they think that we are so stupid that just telling us you're my favorite, even in a way that's very blatantly, well, you're not really my favorite, but astounding to me. It shows how little they
I think it happens in relationships too.
Oh, absolutely it does.
The fat ass I just broke up with, yeah.
Good. Congratulations, then. Well,
he had no idea. He tried to tell me, you and your, what do you call them, my demons. I was like, my demons? You're the demon. You're the cause of all this, because you say this and you say that and try to make me feel bad about your problems and make me think they're mine. I said, dude, you need to get the heck up out of my house, like for real. You got to go, like right now. And I was like, you better
I'm
glad I can walk, because I've been bad. Yay, she's back.
Welcome back.
I'm halfway through speaking, and my phone just hangs up, and I was like, and apparently I'm done.
I know. We were like hanging on to every word too. We were like, what?
What?
But yeah, anyway, okay, well, it's just amazing. It's just amazing to me. And it's, again, it's a stunning poem. And Mika, thank you for being willing to share even your experience, because I think sometimes you can feel like you're going mad in situations such as that. And so I think when it's exposed how common these things are, it can be, maybe it'll help someone who's second guessing what they're going through, because it's a very, as you know, isolating experience. So
right on.
That's it. That's all I got to say.
Absolutely.
Where are we headed to now?
Well, Fallon, I put up a piece by Darlene Thompson, and would you give that a read for us?
Absolutely, but I was going to say, that's all I got to say about that, you know. This is by Darlene Thompson, Small Hands. Poison covers the soul, destroying the outer part of flesh. As the small hands caressing the mother's tenderness of love, sadness, looking for hope, surrounding by droppling colors that tries to break the connection of small hands, that clinging to a mother affection that is so tightly holding on to her. Dry lips has not spoken words. Silent has no air to breathe. Blindness has no lights to face. Still the small hands caressing the mother's tenderness of love. Poison cannot separate the small hands that so gracefully touch with the warmth of a mother's tenderness, love. It is said 1,000 years of mother's life is a matter of time when the child is born in the heart of a mother's tenderness, love. She will always protect small hands in point.
Beautiful read, Fallon. Thank you. And an awesome write by Darlene Thompson. Mika, would you mind starting us off with what you thought of this one?
Yeah, this is a hard one for me. I think what I'm getting from it is the way that that being a mother and that, you know, having children can kind of influence your outlook and your perspective on life. So it's almost to me less about poison weaning the child, and almost more about how the child's innocence and dependence can help draw the poison out of the mother. To an extent, I think that I relate to this. Like, you know, as you guys probably know, I got custody of my siblings when my mom passed away. And before that, I feel like I was kind of just drifting, maybe directionless, and having a purpose did something good for me in my life. But being responsible for them, you know, at first felt so heavy that, I mean, I think when I first got the custody, I was thinking as soon as they're old enough to take care of themselves, as soon as they're 18, I'll just end my life too. I can't deal with this. And, the connections that you form, whether it's from the responsibility of motherhood or parenthood, or just from love within family, can really heal that poisonous thinking, that thinking that will not allow you to live, that will not allow you to experience joy. And so to me, it's almost like a reversal of the prompt. It's the way that innocence and love can soothe your soul and break the illusion that you had of a joyless existence. Yes, there is pain. Yes, there is hardship. Yes, there is harm that you can't protect your loved ones from. But there is also the small joys, the small hands, you know, holding you on either side of your face, caressing. So I think there's a real beauty to it.
I think that was really poignant of a statement because, you know, originally I kind of struggled reading this too, because it does seem like this inseparable bond that's depicted that is impervious to that poison, which, like you said, doesn't really feel like weaned on poison. But I love how you mentioned that it can even be that innocence, that love, that purpose that draws the poison out of the mother. Because we all go through life with trauma. We all have these things that we have to learn to overcome, learn to reconcile, accept, move on from, what have you. And you actually reminded me, so I am a second daughter. My mother
never wanted to have girls. And I was the second daughter, with my brother being the third. So guess who the golden child is. But my whole life, I was told by my mother that I was a disappointment because she wanted me to be a boy. And she was, even though my dad's a diagnostic radiologist and I told her it's going to be a girl, she still believed until I was born that I was going to be a boy. She just was sure of it. And I wasn't. So you kind of start seeing why things were handled the way they were. Well, before I became a mother, I too wanted boys. And now I have two daughters. And I remember distinctly my pregnancy with my youngest because I was terrified. Again, I don't have a good relationship with my sister. I didn't have a good relationship with my sister growing up. I haven't had a good relationship with my sister in my adulthood. And so I was terrified that I would not love this second daughter the way I loved my first, because my mother did not love me the way she loved my eldest sister, my sister. And I feared that my daughters would not have a good relationship because I didn't grow up in a household with a good relationship with my sister. And so I love your interpretation of this because the way in which I've gotten to see how I can love both my daughters as they are in their own ways equitably means that there's nothing wrong that's deficient with me. I've gotten to have this fear leached from my soul, this pain leached from my soul, to watch my daughters actively play together, to watch my eldest try and help my youngest. I've gotten to enjoy the beauty of that. And in many ways, that pain and that trauma that has put a dark little spot in my soul has been leached from it. So I think your comment really hits this poem in its purpose and its intent, that idea of pulling the pain, pulling the poison that is within us that causes the fear and the doubt, and how sure those tiny little hands cup our faces, knowing in its innocence that you are perfect as you are. I think that's just a really beautiful thing. And yeah, it's not weaned on poison, but it does show how poison might be weaned from us. So thank you for that comment, Mika. And thank you, darling, for this amazing poem. And Felon, what did you think having read it?
I'm fixing to blow y'all's mind. I'm thinking I'm going a whole different little way here. I do believe this is a mother that at birth, giving birth, she passed because the poison covering the soul is destroying the outer part of the flesh. That's the decomp of the body, but yet the hands are caressing the mother's tenderest of love. They probably still let the child lay on the breast of the mother after birth, and then the sadness looking for hope. You know, it's the sadness because of the death of the mother surrounded by dropping colors that tries to break the connection of small hands, because that's the color of basically the pulling of the blood to the, you know, libidity. And then clinging to the mother's affection and tightly holding on to her, just trying to cling on to, you know, trying to hold her into this world when she's already gone. And then dry lips has no spoken words, and silent that no air, and silence has no air, the breath. Basically, she's dead. Blindness has no lights to the face. Death. Still small hands caressing the mother, tenderness of love. And it, by like this, poison cannot separate the small hands, no matter what, even in death. You can't separate the small hands of a mother and a child that's so gracefully touched with the warmth of a mother's tenderness, love. And then it is said 1,000 years ago, a mother's life is a matter of time when a child is born in the heart of a mother's tenderness, love, and she will always protect the small hands. At the moment of birth into our lives, into our minds and everything, it doesn't matter what happens thereafter, because even in birth, even if the mother passes, they still are birthed into a greatness of that of a being a mother. So that's what I think.
Oh, Felon, I love that comment. And you actually too reminded me again of the psychiatrist or psychologist the therapist that I was seeing, who just kind of noted that no matter how toxic our relationship with our parents are, so many times we will still crave a relationship with them. And we will long for it. And that can be like the death
of a mother that can be that earnest need of tiny hands, even when we are older, begging that connection, even though they are gone, be it as a mother, be it physically. I think that was a really poignant comment, Fallon. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
All right, Amika, Amika, where do you want to take us to next?
Well, next I have a poem by Ephesiana, and I will go ahead and give this a read, and it's called Weaned on Poison. Instinct is the imprint on first caregiver, even if poison is all they deliver. Children needing to believe they are loved much interpret their guardians' cruel actions as such. Hot tempers intertwined with attention, internalized lies about intention, berating interpreted as constructive compliment. Later in life, respond to wrong signals sent. Violence normalized, expected, protected, attentive partner pushed away the neglected. End poem.
Beautifully read, Mika. Thank you. And such a forceful and powerful write by Ephesiana. I think what is really amazing about this is that it blatantly calls out the way in which we cling to, again, the people that birth us, our parents, because we seek that connection. And yet, because they're not truly caring, because they may be abusive, because we may be dealing with an unhealthy person who just doesn't have the capacity to love as a parent should, the way in which that can affect the child even later on in life. I think that's such a poignant and hard-hitting statement, because we do seem to think that because someone keeps us alive as a child, somehow we've twisted it to mean that they care, and oftentimes it's just the bare necessities. It's not true affection and love as the soul actually needs to create these secure connections. And so we have those attachment styles later on in life that poison the relationships that we're even in. Just absolutely stunning, right? That I think really makes us dive deep into the way in which we connect with people even, and how those initial connections can ripple through the rest of our life in unexpected ways, all because we were ill prepared from the start. Really, really quite phenomenal. And Fallon, what did you think of this?
I was very impressed with Fagiana's direct power, the power in this in itself. Instinct is to imprint on first caregiver, even if poison is all over their delivered children, needing to believe they are so loved. I think this has to do with like a parent, step-parent kind of thing, because interpret the guardian's cruel intentions as such. Hot tempers intertwined with intention. And then the berating is interpreted as a constructive compliment. I can so see that in a step-parent, basically trying to, you know, berating, basically thinking they're giving a constructive criticism, but yet it's so not, because it's basically really blatantly just saying what they think. And saying, well, what? I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to build you up. It's a good comm. It's constructive, because you just need to take it as constructive and take it the advice and build on that. And failing to see how they just totally step all over that person's spirit and really just don't give a shit, don't really care what they do. And it really makes you accept the violence even in a boisterous way and physical way. So when you do find someone that's attentive to you and cares for you and listens, you know what, you just normally push them away, because you know what, you expect to be abused. So, hell, I have someone really there, I'll just neglect, I'll keep them at a far. I'm not going to let them all the way in. So this is very powerful. I think it's nicely constructed, and it's very hard-hitting. Great job, Ephesiana.
Oh, I think that was such a powerful statement, Fallon. Thank you for sharing that, and you're right. I do agree that so many times abuse is waved away as being something that's supposed to be helpful or constructive, and we just don't take it right. Again, that victim blaming kind of mentality and the way in which it plays later on, just fantastically said. And Mika, what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to come out on this without reiterating what you guys have said.
this really gets to the heart of the prompt, because it's not just about, oh, you were poisoned, you have trauma. It's that the being poisoned from infancy completely destroys your perspective of reality. And that harm is really, really well laid out here when you talk about berating, interpreted as constructive compliment, later in life respond to wrong signals sent. I mean, it completely affects your ability to engage in relationships, and you respond positively to relationships that are harmful to you. And, you know, I don't know. I think this is just the piece that really gets the heart of this prompt and says exactly what the prompt says, but just expounds on it, expounds on the consequences and the devastation that arise from your perspective being so mutated by a caregiver.
Well, I think that was an amazing comment. And I honestly, this whole poem and both what you and Felon have said, Mika, really remind me again of that attachment style, which is actually, if I don't know if everybody's heard of attachment styles. It was something I just recently learned a couple of years ago. But depending on how you were raised, you can have different attachment styles. So I actually have an anxious avoidant attachment style, and my husband has just a flat out avoidant attachment style. And so it's, for mine, it's often like I'm expecting people to hurt me. And so I will be almost hypervigilant of it. Whereas his, he's completely calm until there's confrontation, and then he just nope on out of there. And it's really interesting because you start to understand how your nurturing kind of affects it. And I feel like this poem and both your guys' comments really do remark upon that, upon the way in which our psychology, our approach to relationships completely changed because of how we were treated and how we learned to define relationships, and specifically loving relationships, all because of what that mother-child or father-child, parent-child relationship is supposed to be, only to find out that our experience was not great. And most people don't have a secure attachment style, but it's always interesting to see just how these things have affected us. So anyways, fun thing to do if you ever get bored, take a test on your attachment style. So anyways, awesome comments, awesome poem. And where do you want to take us to next, Mika?
Well, next I have a poem by Rirooney664. And will you read this, please, Victoria?
I would love to. This is Poisoned and Poisoned by Proxy by Rirooney664. Red fog blaring in his skull, flashbacks to his bed, a chloroform cloth, his lips coated and wet, his nose smelling the sweet notes. Puzzle pieces he can't put together, fractured facilities frozen in place. He can't unlock the door, screaming in his sleep, twisting in the sheets, his father's voice saying, "Go to sleep." Sweat and darkness washing over him, the lacrimal waterfalls flood down his face. Water glass breaks in his hand, shards slipping deep into his skin. Arsenic-laced whispers damaged his nights. Moth to a flame, he seeks him out, poisoned but pulled in. A paperclip to his magnetic persona. The grip is too ginormous. Not even defenestration stopped his determination. To this day, he is poisoned, and poisoned by proxy. End poem. Oh, that's a fun one. So I'm going to just briefly comment. At first, I thought this was going to be kind of a call to Munchausen syndrome and Munchausen syndrome by proxy. And I feel like psychologically, this is almost talking about that. So instead of actually poisoning someone to get attention or poisoning yourself to get attention, you're psychologically damaging because you are psychologically damaged, possibly. Anyway, I want to think a little bit more on it. So Mika, would you mind sharing some thoughts?
Oh, man. Well, I don't know. This is hard for me to comment on because it's, I think this is very dark. Red fog blaring his skull, flashbacks to his bed, a chloroform cloth, his lips coated and wet, his nose smelling with sweet notes. I mean, to me, it's talking about the way that memories can disguise, erase, or hide themselves as a self-defense mechanism, because your brain knows how damaging it would be to really recall these events. But you still have the traces of that trauma. So there's this foggy recollection. The red fog blaring is that warning light of there's something that happened. You may not remember all of it, but its after effects are still very present. And to me, I don't know. There's notes of sexual abuse in this. That's what I'm getting from it. And of the way that our memories block that out, but that it's completely ineffective, a survival mechanism that is inadequate at best. And it seems like, you know, when we read earlier, we read Becky Upchurch's poem, and it was talking about vomiting the poison out and like drawing it out, and how without giving shape to it with words, it was poisoning from the inside. But when it was released, she was able, the patient was able to kind of define themselves, to give themselves color and flesh themselves out. And here I feel like we see the poison of not being able to do that, of being taunted by the glimpses of a memory that you can't allow yourself to fully look at, and how its effects cannot be mitigated until you face it. But facing it is a poison in and of itself. It's a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of situation.
I think that was a really fantastic comment, because you're right. I agree. This is a super dark piece. And like you, it does feel like there are those sexual assault notes in it, and the way that the mind forgets. I think that was really insightful, especially given how this piece hits, because it does have that sense of confusion to it, and yet you know it's bad. Like, there's no question that there's almost this PTSD effect going on. So, yeah, just fantastic comment, Mika. Thank you. And Felon, what did you think?
Mine's a little different, obviously. I don't get that. What I'm gaining from this is not in the. Is, I think it's more of a metaphorically sense of the chloroform cloth that his lips coated with wet, his nose smelling the sweet notes. I think that basically, as a child, you know, he was told how to think. Even it could have been something as long. It could have been a white supremacist group. It could be the Black Panthers. It could be just any group or any way of thinking that is different from than is the norm of social of society thinks. I think he's being told how to actually think and how to represent. Because if you go into the part where it says, where'd it go? Poison bit pulled into the paper clip to the magnetic persona. The grip of the denarius not only desensitized that. Basically, that means that is someone of authority, someone that leads that person on, stops his determination. This is the day he is poisoned, and poisoned by proxy. And by proxy is by what we represent. And that's, and I think it's representing a group, a thought, a culture, a cult. I mean, it could be anything, but the water glass breaks in his hands and shards slipping deep into the skin. Arsenic lace whispers damaged his nights. Moth to the flame, he seeks him out. And I think that no matter how he just, you know, how hard he grips that glass of water, trying to choke down what they're trying to tell him, he still breaks, and he still bleeds from this shit. And it's killing him. It's lacing his whispers even in the night, and just like a moth to a flame, it's going to draw it in, and he still gets drawn in. So I mean, this is just very, very powerful, right? I think that it really hits the prompt very well. And I'm just overwhelmed the intelligence and this very well put together. Great job.
I really love that take on it, actually, because you're right. There can be kind of that poisoning of the mind and the spirit when you are in one of those kind of cultish settings. Or even if it's not a cult, some people just get so obsessive over some things that it might as well be a cult. And so I think that's really fantastic in your commentary, because so many times there are those people who are trying to have this free thought and break away from it, and yet they are so trapped that even as they resist, they are still poisoned in that resistance. Things still leach into them that damage them and penetrate their defenses. So I think that was actually quite a stunning commentary, Fallon, and I'm so glad that you brought that to the table. Just really
Thank
fantastic.
You.
Yeah. And I'm actually going to take the third stance, which was the one that I originally mentioned, where there's kind of this poisoned and then, you know, Munchausen syndrome by proxy, poisoned and poisoned by proxy. And honestly, this is probably a personal review. But what specifically stuck to me is, let's see, twisting in the sheets, his father's voice saying, go to sleep, sweat and darkness washing over him. So my husband's parents are much better people now than they were. There was more than once where his father and mother would get in an argument and his father would take his anger out on my husband to the extent that he could not go to school the next day, if you catch my drift. His father was military, and then of course my husband went into the military, and there is, as much as I love him, there is an emotional stunting sometimes with the military because you're not supposed to feel all the things, especially with all the trauma that you're put into. And so that phrase, go to sleep, actually hits me in a very personal way, because I remember as a child screaming in my bed for my parents to come, and one of them always would. Now, they may not be happy, but they would come and they would soothe me and I would be able to go back to sleep. And one of the struggles with my work at my job is that there are some days when I have to be up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And so when if my daughters have a nightmare or have a bad night, and it's my youngest has never slept great. My eldest always slept amazing. But when she screams, it's because she's actually old enough to start having nightmares. And when she screams, it wakes the youngest because the youngest just doesn't sleep well. And one point of contention with my husband is that often because he has severe apnea, like severe, bad is like anything above 25 apneas an hour. And he, without a CPAP machine, has between 68 and 72 apneas an hour, which means he's having one, at least one every minute. And there's central apneas due to a brain trauma, so he just stops breathing. So sleep to him is very precious. And because of this emotional dissonance from how he was raised, and because he did not get that comfort, even when our four-year-old starts crying because she has a nightmare, his knee-jerk reaction is to yell from the bed, go to sleep. And that's where I think this kind of sticks with me, because that's the poison from his childhood in his soul. That's the poison of parents that were not in a place to emotionally care for someone who is young and does not know how to handle that fear yet. Even when the kids cry because they're four and they're two, and they're big emotions and they don't know how to handle them completely. And my eldest is just now being able to start saying, I'm frustrated. That's why I'm crying. I'm scared. That's why I'm crying. I didn't like that. That's why I'm crying. He doesn't always have the ability to pause himself and say, okay, we're feeling some big emotions. What are the big emotions? Let's work through the big emotions. And if he himself is overwhelmed because he himself is emotionally stunted, then he will often do the same thing of stop crying. It doesn't make the kids stop crying. It just makes them, it makes them hide those emotions. And so that poison, and I'm not a perfect parent either. We all parent with traumas. And we all, like I always say, you know, as much as I don't want to fuck up my kids, I know I'm going to fuck up my kids. Not going to do it intentionally, but it's probably going to happen. But even with all of that in mind, that poison from his childhood, that trauma, those items that he's experienced leach into his parenting, and he recognizes them and he tries to do better and he catches himself and he's trying to correct. But it's still that poisoning by proxy. It's that poison that he is letting leach against them, into them, because he doesn't know how to handle it. And so I feel that in this way. So often we can have some of the worst people, think serial killers, who come across as the most charismatic, the most magnetic, because they are so deeply traumatized that they just hide everything. And you think about the relationships that could come with that. The children, the bind, torture, BTK killer, bind, torture, kill killer, who was only caught because there was an article that came out about him that he had died. They thought that the killer had died because they hadn't solved it. And so he ended up writing, corresponded with a cop who he thought was actually like his friend and proud of him, who was actually using it to capture him. And the effect that had on his children, that by, even though he wasn't necessarily malicious to them, he still poisoned them because that is not the person that they knew. And they start to understand the mask that they were seeing and think of the poison and the damage and the trauma that comes to the soul. And this piece just really strikes me as that. The way in which our poisons, our traumas, our darkness leaches into the beautiful, pure light of our relationships, of our children, because we are poisoning them by proxy. They would not have that poison. They may have other poisons, but they wouldn't have our poison if they were not so close to us. And so I think that's what kind of sticks to me in this piece, is the way in which even small things, those moments when our knees, as simple as being terrified of the dark or waking from a bad dream, are not met, how that small thing can be that little mustard seed that begins the darkness in a soul, that begins that slope of trauma that will one day have to be reconciled with and the weed will have to be pulled. I think it's just, I love that everyone got a different meaning out of it, because it shows how beautifully complex poetry is and can be, that it can speak to each person so differently and yet so poignantly and substantially. So thank you guys for this beautiful, beautiful commentary on this piece. And thank you too, to this poet, to this author, for providing a piece that's so dynamic that, some amazing commentary can really come out of it, and valid commentary. So fantastic, right? Fantastic comments, guys. And Mika, where would you like to take us now?
Well, next up we have a poem by Nan529. And would you give that a read for us, Felon?
Absolutely. And this is by Nan529. It's called Parent Annihilation. Sorry. Hush, hush, can you hear it? Listen, it's dripping. Drip, drip, drip. The poison enters the ears. Silent whispers, lies being told. Poison pours slowly into the ear. Text messages you didn't know read. One-sided, all lies. Slowly, slowly, they start to believe his lies. It's poison dripping, seeping through their veins. Truth rewritten, replaced by lies, till they feed their poison social media. It's all lies. Now they're turning against you. Poison is working. He has revenge. He's planned this for so long. They don't see how he's manipulated them. He betrays the victim they have to protect. His flying monkeys dismiss truth, how their father beat his wife. Son stands in front of his mother telling her, "My dad, not like that. You must have asked for it." You ask, where is it right for a man to hit a woman? His ears are still unable to accept the truth. He turns on you. Drip, drip, drip. The poison has worked. He is one taking back his flying monkeys. He caused the most hurt. He broke your heart. He has sick revenge. Now it's time to wait, praying one day the light bulb will go off in their heads. One day they will realize the truth, and will they see them again? Love once more will bear its fruits. No more lies. God will walk by our side. It takes time. This I know from the heart. One day they will realize the truth will come out. End point.
Beautifully read, Fallon. And I think this is just a really stunning piece for two reasons. First, it reminds me of the idea that children are listening even when we don't recognize it, that our words impact them in ways that we don't always mean. And I actually had a moment with my eldest the other day, and again, not a perfect parent, so not going to pretend I am, but she just done something really bizarre. I mean, it was like she'd taken a permanent marker and colored on a wall or something. It was just like one of those things where she knew she wasn't supposed to. And so I just looked at her and I was like, what is wrong with you, child? Like, why did you do this? Maybe even like kicked her sister off a chair, because that happens sometimes. And you just look at me like, what is wrong with you? But it gave me a brief moment of pause, because those words could allow my daughter, having heard them, if she heard them enough, could make her believe that there's something actually wrong with her. And there's not. In fact, because one of her love languages is words of affirmation. Daily, I sit and I always remind her before she goes to bed all her beautiful qualities that I'm thankful for in her, because I want her to remember that as much as I may fail to always speak my thoughts in a polite and loving manner, i.e. don't say what's wrong with you, I want her to know every night all the beautiful and good things about her, because poems like this, because our words and our actions mean things to them, and they see things and they understand far deeper than sometimes that we give them credit for, because I personally believe that tiny humans are born complete tiny humans. They just have stuff to learn, but they're not stupid. I also appreciate in this poem that there's this dual meaning laced therein, where we can see how even an abusive parent can shield or protect the child so that they will not villainize them, i.e., you know, you must have done something to deserve being beat, because my father is kind and loving. And it's again, that weaning on poison so poignantly stated, because there are those relationships where it's so apparently toxic. And I actually think of my uncle, who I remember walking through his house with my aunt in the kitchen, and he was in the master bedroom with his girlfriend, and how watching my cousins struggle with, this is my father, I love him, and him having multiple affairs on their mother, and the older ones knowing that he and his buddy would get drunk, buddies would get drunk, and they would rape my aunt. And yet there's still that belief that there's something good in there. And the way in which those relationships too can be a weaning of poison, because suddenly they think that there's something normal about it. It's just, I think it's a really stunning piece that looks at abuse in two ways. the way it impacts children, and also the way in which we kind of try and hide it and believe that assign the blame elsewhere. So my thoughts aren't clear, but it's stunning, absolutely stunning. And Mika, what did you think?
Great comments, guys. I guess what I'll add is it reminds me of a quote from The Poisonwood Bible by Barbara Kingsolver, almost as much as it reminds me of the prompt quote. And in the Poisonwood Bible, it was about the mother. She said that she always tried to shield her children from the glare of the abusive father. But like flowers, they consistently turn to him like flowers do towards the sun, looking for something. I mean, no matter how deranged or abusive or harmful a parent is, the child looks for the sun in them. They look for the love. When it's not given, when it's denied, it doesn't matter how much you try to shelter them from that, they see it. And so they're easily pulled by these kinds of, I guess I would call them substitutes for real love and attention. And in this case, you know, the shared experience of an enemy in mom, is something that they can, obviously the father is using to manipulate them into feeling on his team, into feeling that camaraderie that you want to feel with your father. So yeah, that's what it reminded me of.
I love that. Thank you, Mika. And I think sometimes we do forget that in abusive households, there can be that camaraderie because it's also a defense mechanism. If they're both united against mom, then at least the child is not being beaten too. So, and not that it works, but stunning comment. And Felon, what did you think?
I'm going to go through this with my boys, and their father is very abusive. One thing I learned quickly and everything is don't defend shit. It's not even a child's conversation. I wouldn't even discuss it because it's not for their ears. For me to defend or put him down because he done it well enough on his own, and I didn't have to say anything. And I think when the parent just tries to relate, but did you see what he did? Did you see what he did? You know, you're annihilating him too. I think that you put in a child into your relationship, and I think it's wrong, and I think that you should just keep your mouth shut. They know what the hell went on, and it'll come out. And I think that, and it did with my boys, you know. There were things said, but you know what? I never once spoke ill of their father after everything that he did to me, because you know what? I knew that I was a poison to them if I did, because I was going to basically change their perception of a man who they're supposed to be mentored from. And I knew in time that he would change his ways and become the father he was supposed to be, and that he needed, because I knew his past life with his mother and father. And sometimes you just have to take a back seat to your feelings and to what you want your child to perceive, because they already know the fucking truth. You don't need to say shit. Let it be. Why sit there and keep digging up worms into something that's already decomping? I mean, just let it go, because they don't deserve that. They've already seen enough, and they don't need to hear any more of it. And I think that's what people fail to see, is sometimes you need to let kids be damn kids and keep your adult bears to yourself, because they've had enough, and they've seen enough. And I'm glad I did that with my boys. I'm really glad I did that with them. And they didn't have to be on this side or that side. They were able to be on the side that they wanted to be on. So this is a very hard-hitting point, and sometimes people just need to learn that the kids be kids and be adult themselves. They don't need their damn kid to come in and fight for them. They can fight for themselves, fight for their kid by not putting them in it. That's all I got to say.
I think that was a really powerful comment, Ellen, because you're right. A lot of times there is that pitting of one parent against the other, especially when it's not – you know, the quote-unquote happy, harmonious home. And in many ways, we are, you know, when that happens, you could even be attacking a portion of your child because it took both parents to create the child, you know, and so they're a piece of them, and pulling children into that discord so oftentimes does not build the child up, but tears them apart, you know, cutting the baby in half, if you will. So I think that's a really beautiful, powerful comment that reminds us that adult discord is not the place to pull children into. I really appreciate that. Thank you. And Mika, where would you like to take us in our last 30 minutes?
Okay, so next up we have a poem by June Johnson. I will go ahead and give this a read. And it's called Only the Walls Knew How Much She Was Hated. Mother's breast septic, her tiny mouth against this giant in upper caps. The monster is not under the bed, and God is a few streets down. Mother breaking the cross above her bed, splinters in her foot. Death hangs like a dream catcher of weeds and teeth, taking a razor to her arms, blood dripping on paper. Porcelain flesh pressed under glass with no clothes. Coughing up braille from her lungs, spitting it on a page, scars making her a poet. The walls hear her like a psychic, gypsy moths chewing the vowels out of her womb. Crows do not fly here, apron strings, a noose, and a hint dangling in midair. Even God does not pray for the girl with no womb, mother dancing with the butcher, a dead rose in her hair. End poem.
Oh, this poem gives me chills. Fallon, would you mind starting us off with what you thought of it?
One, June is a fucking talented, talented writer. I think she is a brutal with just truth. And I think this is a one to hold that. It says, only the walls knew how much she was hated. Wow. Death hangs like a dream catcher of weeds and teeth. Taking a razor to her arms, blood dripping on paper, porcelain flesh pressed under glass with no cloth. Wow. Are you shitting me? This is just like in your face. And the mother dancing with the butcher and the dead rose in her hair. Even God does not pray for that girl with no womb. I think it's sad that parading the fact that she's unable to bear a child or something happened that took that from her, and the mother is taking pleasure from it because basically she's saying, see, you wanted to judge me, but look at you. I think at least I got kids. I mean, that's what I get from this. And, you know, the walls were hurt like her psychic. Yeah, this is some powerful shit right here. Just excellent. Excellent as always. Great job, Jean.
Thank you. Really beautifully said, Fallon. And I agree, especially where you mentioned how the mother, how she doesn't have a womb, and the mother is almost gleeful in it. Because while your comment being, you know, see, at least I have a kid, it reminded me of perhaps even a word of spite that perhaps she is not worthy to be a mother. That for whatever reason, this wicked woman was allowed to be a mother, and yet the offspring that feels so deeply and desires so purely to love and to be loved is deemed not worthy. And how, man, how cruel would that be? Those words, how cruel of a soul must someone have? How rotten of a soul must someone have to take joy in such suffering? This poem speaks so deeply of pain, of hate, of the way in which someone may be called a parent, mother, father, but that doesn't mean that they've actually earned the title. And it reminds me of the distinction of a mother versus a mom, even. Because a mother sometimes can be seen as something, it's a place, it's a title, but I know when my 2-year-old looked at me, because you're mom, not mommy. There was almost like this, but mommy's so innocent. And mom's like, I don't know. I'm not ready for you to call me that. But yeah, this is a hard poem to read, because it feels hateful from this mother, from this woman, this birth giver, compared to the deep pain that is welled in the way in which sometimes the only way it feels to get the emotion out is to let it bleed from you in ink and word. So just, hard poem to read, to hear. And Mika, what did you think of it?
I really like this. I think this is a really cool poem on the generational nature of depression and to me of suicide, because the mother is laying the groundwork for the child's trauma and mental illness, but not necessarily out of malice in my mind in the way this is written, but out of her own pain, her own trauma, and her own dance with the butcher. That ending stanza is just incredible. Mother dancing with the butcher, a dead rose in her hair, dancing with the butcher, dancing with death itself, it seems to me. And there, you know, to have a caregiver who is so fucked up themselves, means that there is no comfort for you. You never have I hate to say shoulder to cry on, because that doesn't really capture what I'm saying, but that safety and security, they're in their own dance with their own demons. And so you're left to inherit the remnants when they finally do succumb.
Oh my goodness, Mika, that is such a powerful comment, because sometimes we forget that our parents' issues can leave those fragments that still can pierce our soul and make a home take root in our heart. Just wow, I love your interpretation of this, and how it impacts generations, not just one or two, but it can truly impact generations. Beautifully said. Thank you for that. And where would you like to take us to next?
All right. Well, next up we have a poem by Elizabeth Murmuring. And Fallon, would you give that a read for us?
Absolutely. It could be my last one, guys. I'm sorry. Here we go. And this is by Elizabeth Murmuring. It's called Acclimation. How do you say that? Acclimation. Yeah. I saw a butterfly today. They say they were dancing clouds of Madrid colors, floating over flower fields, rainbow breeze fluttering in sunshine. I don't know this. They make such fanciful claims, beetles in slow, shimmering procession, pale photosynthesis, I guess, winking over riverbanks, being tripping from blossoms to busy hives, dripping sweet syrup, moss wind swirling under star snow. They say cooler air were rippled, pomegranate, I think, but my skies are unwavering blue steel. I saw a butterfly today. They might have been beauty in the dance, but I do not feel the loss. I'm going, whoa.
Fantastic read, Fallon. Definitely with a few of those big $5, I don't know, even $10 words. Fantastic read. Thank you for that. And thank you for the right, Elizabeth Murmuring. Mika, would you start us off with your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I really like the imagery in this. And they make such fanciful claims, beetles in slow shimmering procession, pale phosphorescence winking on riverbanks, bees tripping from blossom to busy hive. That whole stanza is just full of really, really beautiful imagery. I don't know. the title and the imagery, to me, it was difficult to draw what it was saying. But looking at the ending, I'm thinking that acclimatization is desensitizing of yourself to the loss of beauty, to the loss of something important, but seemingly unimportant because you can just turn away to the next thing. So that's what I got from it.
I think that was really, really insightful in this because we do have those times when we have this desensitization. In fact, the biggest one in my life is zombies. I hate zombies. As a kid, Shaun of the Dead, a joke film, had me sleeping on my parents' floor in their bedroom when I was in high school. I don't like zombies. But I've watched like enough Walking Dead at this point, or Fear the Walking Dead and The Walking Dead, that they don't actually bother me so much anymore. I acclimatize that fear. I desensitize that fear. And there are many ways in which we do desensitize ourselves to fanciful thinking because we start trying to see what everybody else is saying because it's better to be to relate than to be isolated. But I agree. This is a hard piece to kind of wrap back into that weaned on poison. I think my interpretation, very similar to yours, Mika, is that, and it goes along with the picture, or even perhaps a winter rose, because you can have these flowers, you can have these plants that don't belong in winter or don't belong in fall or summer or spring, and yet they acclimate to it because perhaps winters are getting shorter or summers are getting, or springs are getting hotter or falls are getting shorter or just what have you. And so there's this forced ideal that you either have to acclimate or die. And so here's this person who doesn't see the butterflies. They don't see the beetles. They don't see these fanciful things because this is not the time and the place for those things. Perhaps it's still winter with snow on the ground. Why would there be butterflies? Why would there be beetles? And yet, as they are looking around, as they are understanding that this world demands of them to do this, that their situation is dire and hopeless, they begin to look perhaps even for that hope. They acclimate in a way possibly to the abuse. And it reminds me, actually, my sister, I've spoken about multiple times, she's in an abusive marriage, and her husband just came back from a wedding without her, and he's being very loving, very kind, and she is yet again thinking of staying in the marriage because, well, you know, maybe if this stays, this would be great. And it's that cycle that you see in abuse where they can do terrible, terrible things to you, to those you love. And yet, as soon as they're nice, you start seeing those butterflies. You start seeing the beetles because it's better than recognizing that they're frozen and dead. Because that's a hard reality. And sometimes we're not ready to leave this spot by the river. And so instead, we focus on the pretty things while we wait ourselves to die. A little bit of a darker thought process there, but that's kind of what stuck to me in this piece. It's a way that sometimes we try and find reason, even if it's not really there, so we make it up. Really interesting piece. And Ellen, would you mind giving a comment before you leave?
Sure. I too seen the fact that this is a person that has come to feel no warmth, and that even though the light shimmers through, and the winking of the riverbanks, that's basically the light glimmering off the water, the bees tripping from blossom to busy hive, you know, all the things, life still is busy, it's going to be busy, still dripping sweet syrup, and the moth wind swirling under stars, snow, you know, that even they are still able to continue to soar even when it's so cold that most of them usually just lie frozen or just still. Now this person is the one laying still. They're unable even, but my skies are unwavering blue still. They do have hope, but they're still stuck in that frozen moment of themselves, and they can't find warmth in anything. And even though everything is beautiful and shimmery around them, they can only see certain things, and that's just the stillness of what used to be. So this is a beautiful rite.
Beautiful, beautiful comment, Fallon. And I love how you found that stillness and how things used to be. Beautifully said.
Thank you.
Anything else? I don't want to just like kick you off the air. So anything else you'd like to add before you abandon us? And I'm going to use abandon to maybe guilt you into staying the last 15 minutes.
No, I'll be back. It was nice spending some time with you ladies, and y'all have a great night, and I'm getting stronger and stronger by the day. So you can't break me. I'm like a roach in a nuclear holocaust. You can't get rid of me. I ain't going nowhere.
Awesome. Okay. Well, you get better, and I'm going to be holding my breath. So you stay a whole show with us, but I'm so glad you were able to be here tonight. Thank you, Fallon, for your beautiful words and all the wonderful
poem,
reading.
Fallon.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I love you guys. Y'all have a great night. Great show.
Love you. You too. Take care of yourself.
Bye.
All right. So where are you taking us now, Mika?
Okay. Well, next we have a piece by Becky Friend, and would you give that a read, Victoria?
I'd love to. So this is The Comfort of Keepsakes by Becky Friend. I'm a cutter, he softly said, bowing his head as if muttering to himself, teardrops rimming his voice. Words clear but hard to hear, not unfamiliar to my caseworker's ears. Hand-carved scars I've seen on teenage arms, embossed bars across pristine skin like tracks to a train wreck or war wounds. Or telltale tattoos of corrugated clues underneath childhood badges of grief. Every cut runs deep, brings sweet physical agony that masks the pain inside of a young boy still hiding, dodging dark silhouettes and shadow puppets boxing on his bedroom walls, shapeshifters that stalk the night and morph to mom and dad in the daylight, a poison that colors his planet black and blue, keepsake stains, just as ink seeps into granite and blood leaves a fingerprint on linen. End poem. Oh, man. I'm legitimately covered in goosebumps. Mika, would you mind sharing what you thought of this piece first?
Yeah, this is really beautiful. I see in her Anne that she actually did serve as a social worker, and I can't imagine how difficult it is to have empathy for the people, the children that you're serving in that position, and still maintain your own sanity and mental health, because it's just so difficult not to take on the burdens of those children. I love actually the stanza, dodging dark silhouettes and shadow puppets boxing on his bedroom walls. I like that there's absolutely real harm being enacted, but because it's in memory, and it's being recited, it is, dark silhouettes and shadow puppets. It's not a physical harm anymore. But that doesn't matter in the perspective of the person, because the trauma that you experience, I think in PTSD, it's like your brain can't regulate your fight or flight response as it normally would, and so
yeah.
Small things, shadows can trigger that response. Even when there's nothing physically there threatening. And so I like the way that she worded that.
Absolutely. And I love even how you brought in the PTSD, because part of my husband's profile, his disability profile, is that he is the, and there are many nights where I'm woken because he either has sleep paralysis that plays out demons in the shadows, or he has these vivid, vivid nightmares that wake him up just not in a good space. And so he needs care, and he needs comfort, and he needs a moment to kind of ground himself. And you're right, PTSD really does kind of fill in that void of not knowing fight or flight, wanting to do both, and being overwhelmed by these battles that you have been forced to fight in that you really didn't want to be there. I think that was a really, really important thing to note. So thank you for that, Mika, truly. This piece is hard to read because it's not something I'm proud of, but I'm an ex-cutter. And I always said when I was a teen and young 20s doing that was that it's almost this addiction to pain, because it is the way that kind of got the bad out, the hurt out. And I know that even in some of my darkest hours, my depression is not well maintained. I still have those urges. I know that it won't actually do me any good, but I have kind of like someone who used to smoke aching for a cigarette. I still have that little desire, urge to do that. And I have some pretty ones, because some of them are shaped like hearts, and other ones are just lines upon lines upon lines of places people can't see. And I think this is such a hard poem to read, because it is not so much speaking from the pain of someone who does that, speaking from the understanding of the pain that someone is observing. Because I don't think that people want to be harmful to themselves. I don't think that people run into these things because it's easy and it's enjoyable. I think that often we come to these poor decisions that harm us because we have no other way of coping. That seems to kind of fill that void. And this piece reminds us of that, that these actions, which I don't think anybody's really proud of, is a seeking of comfort. And so these scars now are these little keepsakes of those moments of comfort. Just a really interesting take from someone who probably understands it a little better, even if they may or may not have lived it themselves. They not done it themselves, but instead see just how poisonous some of these living situations can be. Just really quite an interesting write and hard to read. So I'm glad that they brought it. It definitely gives me pause to think and reflect, and I love that. And we've got about 7 minutes left. So what would you like to do, Mika?
Okay, well, I think we can get in two more rides. Maybe we'll go a little bit over. But I will read this next one by Blue Leader 1. And then we have a short one to go right after it. And hopefully we can get the next rides in on the next show. So I'll go ahead and read this. This is called WIP. I'm sitting cross-legged on the floor, cutting myself with a razor blade because I want to feel a hurt so sweet I lick my fingers with it. When I was a child, my parents gave me a stone so hard and heavy it crushed me. It crushes me still. You can't know the horror I feel through time. Sometimes I bang my head on stone walls or punch them with my fist. Blows are not enough. The new world man showed me poisons. The poisons saved me even as they killed me. Without them, I would have gone mad. you need to know. I'm not sad. I'm furious. I want to burn the world with fire. I want everyone and everything to share my agony. Bastards, I want you to know. Sometimes when I sleep, I find some peace, and I think, if I should die before I wake, what dreamless state awaits my fate? End poem.
Oh, my goodness. This is, so, WIP, possibly work in progress. That could just be the accountant in me talking, but that's what I initially think. But it's interesting that it's titled WIP, possibly this work in progress. But instead of improvement, it shows how the soul has deteriorated and been poisoned over the course of time and the acceleration of it. I love, again, that first stanza hits hard for personal reasons. But the second stanza, my parents gave me a stone so hard and heavy, it crushed me, it crushes me still. I actually wrote a piece called Sticks and Stones about kind of those rocks that people throw at you and how over time they kind of get stuck in our head and they weigh us down and they crush us. And so I love that, not that Blue Leader has taken anything from my work, but I love that that's in this piece because, again, it does remind me of Sticks and Stones May Break My Bones. And the fact that it came from a parent is, again, here is someone who's supposed to love you as you are unconditionally, and yet here they are throwing stones at you, weighing you down, crushing your spirit because they don't like what you're doing. They think that they're going to be helpful because of whatever reason, because they're just assholes sometimes. And so here they are trying to get this anger and this darkness and this pain out. And I found, as someone who actually struggles with anger as a defense, I have found that so often I wish to rage because if I am angry, then people can't hurt me. But it is so isolating because often we are punching a wall and just doing damage to ourselves and not fixing anything. I love that there's this scene of something of a new, a better poison because the cutting just doesn't work anymore. The anger doesn't work anymore. And so while it saved them in the sense of bleeding out or destroying their body so easily, so quickly, it still is wearing away at their insides. That boiling rage still continues. And it begs the question, I want everyone and everything to share my agony, bastards, I want you to know. It begs the question, at what point would you believe that someone understands and knows your agony and your rage? Because it's so easy to be caught up in these cycles and never feel so truly heard and truly understood that thought continues. Well, they were close, but they almost got it, except. And you start to find those reasons where because someone did not meet it perfectly the way you wanted, it's just not good enough, which is often, at least for me, what started this, that my own cycle, that I wasn't ever good enough. And so here, if I had written this, if this were me, then I'm repeating that cycle because nobody else will ever understand good enough, will ever know well enough, will ever speak good enough. And so you never find peace. You're never able to cool the rage until it boils over or you die. And what then? Because do angry souls go to heaven? Just a really, really fun intellectual write that shows, I think, the spiraling of madness that can come from the pain that we experience at young ages. And what do you think, Mika?
That was such a beautiful comment. It's hard to follow. I guess the part that spoke most to me was when I was a child, my parents gave me a stone so hard and heavy, it crushed me. It crushes me still. I love the imagery of the stone being given because to me, it recalls
not only the biblical kind of imagery of the millstone being tied around the neck and someone being cast into the sea, how that stone drags them to the bottom, but also there's a very popular Christian work called Pilgrim's Progress, in which the pilgrim, being kind of an analogy for the every Christian, has to carry a heavy burden until he lays it down at the cross. And I don't think that this is an explicitly religious rite, but it brings to me that image of the burden that is not earned, but simply inherited. And I just really love the way that it's put in that. And then immediately in the stanza after, he said, "Sometimes I bang my head on stone walls or punch them with my fist." I really like that too, because it's, the stone doesn't care. The stone is unfeeling. And the fact that the stone walls are brought in as a vent of frustration to punch them or bang your head against, and the blows are not enough, is a testament to the futility in trying to hide from or suppress the stone that you were given as a child. It doesn't go away because you're frustrated with it. It doesn't go away because you're angry with it. And, yeah, I think I like the stone imagery a lot. That's my favorite part of this piece.
Oh, and I love that we're comment.
Thank you.
Oh, go ahead, go ahead.
And I know we're going to go off air, but I think we should maybe try to put – no, you know what? Maybe we should wait, because we'll go ahead and fit the rest of the pieces on in the next show, because I don't want anyone to feel like they were read off air and didn't get enough. So
that's fair. I think that's really fair. But I do want to comment real quick that I love that you even mentioned that the burden sometimes is not earned but inherited, because how generational trauma is definitely a thing, as you and I both know. And so how appropriate to highlight that, because so often we forget that sometimes the cards that we're dealt, the hand that we are given, is not because we did anything wrong, but just because life sucks. And this is the hand we were born into. So I really actually appreciate that, because there is often this desire to justify why someone might have a burden. And sometimes there is just no justification. Sometimes there just is an unfortunate fact that there is. So I really cannot express how much I appreciate that remark. So thank you for that, Mika. So go ahead. You take back the show. You got it, girl.
Oh, I love your commentary too, Victoria. This has been a really, really cool show. I love when we get into back and forth discussion. It sucks, you know, that we have limited time, so we can't always get to every piece. But I really love, you know, kind of delving into the nuances of these rites. And I appreciate so much every person that wrote for the show and gave us permission to discuss these rites on air. I think there's a lot of vulnerability when you write poetry to a prompt like this. And so I just have a lot of respect for all of the authors of the poems that we've read tonight, and appreciation for all of them. And also to you, Victoria, for being an amazing co-host and having such insightful, in-depth commentary to add to the discussion. And to Felon for being here, for reading her own piece, and for adding to the discussion as well. And, I love you all. Thank you all for being here. And it was an awesome show. Can't wait to read the rest on the next one.
Absolutely. Love you. And thank you, truly, for being just a fantastic co-host as well. Like, this show would not be what it is without you. So
thank you, Victoria.
That's all I got. Always.
Have a good
night. All right. Good night.
Good night.